choral. Robert Page also appears as a guest conductor with a number of American symphony orchestras. We'd like to hear from you about these Pittsburgh Symphony programs. I'll give you an address in a moment. This concert was recorded January 5th and 6th, 1985, in Heinz Hall, Pittsburgh, during the orchestra's 58th season. The recordings were produced in cooperation with NPR member station WQED in Pittsburgh. Recording producer and field interviewer was Jim Cunningham. We welcome your comments on these Pittsburgh Symphony programs. Send them to Pittsburgh Symphony Radio, Heinz Hall, 600 Penn Avenue, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 15222. That's Pittsburgh Symphony Radio, Heinz Hall, 600 Penn Avenue, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 15222. This program is made possible with major funding from H.J. Heinz Company and its subsidiary, Weight Watchers International. Support for the distribution of this Pittsburgh Symphony program comes from National Public Radio member stations. I'm Don Lee, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Wrap your troubles in dreams and dream your troubles away. Got some.
Grammy nominee Maxine Sullivan is the featured artist on this week's American Jazz Radio Festival. Join us as Maxine, her musical director Keith Ingham, and their quartet perform on the American Jazz Radio Festival from National Public Radio.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Good afternoon. My name's Terry Gross, and this is the second half of our two-day special series on AIDS, Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome. The AIDS epidemic has created a medical crisis. Doctors and scientists are frustrated by this contagious disease that so far has no cure or preventive vaccine. And the public is afraid and psychologically unprepared for an epidemic that science can't quickly conquer. Probably the main response of most Americans has been, "What can I do to protect myself against AIDS?" On yesterday's program, we discussed the latest knowledge about AIDS. A panel of experts assured us that the latest research shows that AIDS is spread only through direct blood-to-blood contact, such as when drug users share IV needles, or through sexual acts that allow infected semen to enter the bloodstream. This is likely to happen in anal intercourse without a condom, but can also occur in vaginal intercourse. The experts on Fresh Air agreed that you can't get AIDS from casual contact or from kissing. But many Americans don't have the latest information, and fear of getting AIDS has led to panic reactions. In fact, one civil liberties lawyer has called AIDS a social and legal crisis. And that's what today's show is about, the social, legal, and political repercussions of the AIDS epidemic. Medical experts agree that our best hope now of containing the AIDS epidemic is through education about how AIDS is and is not spread, including frank discussions of what is now called safe sex. The primary way we get our information in America is through the mass media. Today we'll look at how the mass media has been covering AIDS. Misinformation has led to hysteria. People with AIDS and people in high-risk populations face job, housing, and insurance discrimination. Some legislators are proposing mandatory blood tests to screen out people with AIDS. We'll hear from one such Pennsylvania legislator and speak with a civil liberties lawyer about how we are balancing the civil liberties of people with AIDS and people who test positive with the rights of people who hope to protect themselves from this fatal disease. We'll also find out about how the Red Cross is protecting the blood supply and the confidentiality of blood donors. The group that has been hit the hardest by AIDS and by AIDS hysteria is gay men. The impact of AIDS on the gay community is one of the subjects covered by Dennis Altman in his new book, AIDS in the Mind of America. He's written at length about the gay movement in his previous books. Altman found that the subject of AIDS brings homophobia to the surface and taps deep fears and insecurities about sexual identity. Altman is an Australian writer who lived in America between 1981 and 85, dividing his time between New York and San Francisco, where he was affiliated with the Institute for Health Policy Studies of the University of California Medical School. I asked Dennis Altman to what extent he thinks it's fair to see AIDS as a gay issue or a gay disease.
I think we have to start off by making very clear that there's no inherent connection between AIDS and homosexuality. And if we take the global count of AIDS cases, as far as we know, a majority of them are not present among gay men. That is, if we include the very many people in Africa, where AIDS is, of course, highly underreported, it's fairly easy to see that there is no necessary inherent intrinsic connection between AIDS and homosexuality. In the United States, it's true that gay men were the group originally most affected by AIDS. But again, the figures are changing somewhat. That is, there appears to be an increasing number of people who are not gay showing up as AIDS cases. That, of course, unfortunately, does not mean to say that AIDS is not a gay issue. I think it's a gay issue because the original conception of AIDS in this country, and indeed in most of the world, was that it was somehow a gay disease. And the truth is that for the first 2 or 3 years of this illness, nobody except for gay organizations and gay-based groups really did anything. If, say, we had the same number of cases, but they had hit Haitians, IV users, hemophiliacs, blood transfusees, but not gay men, we'd be much worse off than we are now. And so you have the situation, say, in New York, where the gay men's health crisis is in fact providing enormous numbers of services to non-gay clients.
Yeah, because as you point out in your book, IV users don't form a community
right.
in that respect. There are self-help groups and mm-hmm. organizations and so on.
Yes, and IV users seem to be the fastest growing category of AIDS cases, particularly on the East Coast.
Because so many gay men, though, have been affected by AIDS, it is a disease that has become very important within the gay community, and many gay men are afraid that they might have been exposed to it or might risk exposure through sexual encounters. In the minds of a lot of people, the disease is tied to two taboos, homosexuality and promiscuity. Do you think that there have been moral arguments used to say, well, AIDS is a result of promiscuity and homosexuality, and AIDS is a sign that homosexuality is bad or promiscuity is bad?
Oh, there have been frequent statements by people calling themselves Christians who say this. Only recently, the president of one of the largest Baptist congregations in the United States said almost word for word what you've just suggested. Jerry Falwell has said it. It's been a fairly common phrase from the radical right, and it's indeed been taken up by people who in other situations might see themselves as more liberal. And of course, this is nothing new. In 19th century America, in the cholera epidemics, which was not linked to sexuality, people also claimed this was the wrath of God. The plague in the Middle Ages was seen as the wrath of God, and in fact, at that stage, Jews were blamed for it, and there were cases of Jews being herded into synagogues and burnt. It seems to be a fairly common human reaction. Now, in this case, as you say, you're dealing with particularly difficult taboos. And again, we come back to this unfortunate fact that the constant emphasis on the linkage between homosexuality and AIDS has made it possible for the right and for the moralists to totally forget all the other people who are affected. Of course, when you talk about the wrath of God, you would have to explain why babies, why blood transfusion recipients, why hemophiliacs, why Haitians with neither homosexual or drug-using histories are getting sick. But those people get forgotten.
Do you think that any gays have actually been believing that, too, that somehow the AIDS epidemic is some kind of punishment for homosexuality and punishment for promiscuity?
I think that at some level, everybody believes it. And I think it's a reality that is very hard sometimes to discuss. But if you grow up in a society, as we all have, in which the idea that homosexuality and indeed sexuality in general is strongly linked with sin, and if a disease comes along which is lethal and which seems to be clearly linked with doing things that the social norms have told you were sinful, it is, I think, almost impossible to escape internalizing that. And a lot of the devastation that AIDS has caused is because of the difficulty I think people have. Partly, I would say, because the clergy have been so extraordinarily remiss in extending compassion. There have been very, very few church leaders, or indeed political leaders in this country, who have ever said a word about the 8,000 people who have died from this disease. And their silence, I think, merely reinforces this fear, often, you know, only half understood and half expressed, that somehow people brought it on themselves.
Because one of the ways of getting AIDS is sexual contact, I think a lot of gay men have been having fewer sexual encounters as a way to cut down their possibilities of exposure. But do you find that a lot of people are kind of torn between changing their sexual lifestyle as a precaution against AIDS and not wanting to do that because they don't want to do anything that would be interpreted as giving in to this moral interpretation of AIDS?
Well, let's be very clear. The number of partners one has nothing whatsoever to do with your risk of contracting AIDS. It is the sort of sexual act that you have with one or many partners. In fact, it would be much safer to have multiple sex following safe sex guidelines than to have sex with one person whom you were introduced to at a banquet if that one person happens to be carrying the HTLV-3 virus. And unfortunately, a lot of the early rhetoric around AIDS blurred that in people's minds, so they didn't understand that. I think that there is the reaction you suggest. I think that we know that gay men have changed their sexual behaviour in ways that are quite dramatic. And we know this not just because people say so. It's not just that I can say, well, I went to a bar and 10 people told me this, which you would be right to discount. We know it because of things like the dramatic fall in VD rates among gay men in every American city that anyone's ever looked at over the last 2 years. So clearly there are large-scale changes. I think what's happened is that many people have gone beyond necessary changes, that there is a retreat from both emotional and sexual involvement altogether, that ironically gay men who in the 70s could be seen as the cutting edge, if you like, of sexual radicalism are now in some ways the cutting edge of sexual conservatism. A lot of gay men over the last few years have quite self-consciously become celibate and have withdrawn from sexual and emotional contact. Others are talking about monogamy in ways that would bring, you know, joy to the hearts of the moral right if they would only for once listen to what gays are saying.
Well, maybe you can explain the context in which sexual radicalism became a political statement and having multiple partners became a sexually political statement.
I think that it's a double thing. Firstly, of course, one of the ways in which homosexuality had always been put down and defined as somehow inferior was to keep on saying homosexuals aren't capable of having long-term relationships. Homosexuality was, in a sense, always defined, particularly male homosexuality. Lesbianism was usually avoided, and if it was discussed, seen as different. But male homosexuality was somehow seen as something connected with furtive, short-lived, anonymous encounters. And in a sense, there was an almost glorifying, and we're going to take the stereotype and reverse it and turn it into a positive aspect. You know, much as blacks took a word like nigger and said we're going to make nigger into something positive. And that, of course, then tied in with a whole radical critique of traditional sexuality and sexual mores, which has a lot of counterparts with feminist analysis in the early 70s, where monogamy was seen as involving ownership. And it was argued that in order to build a movement, to build comradeship, to build community, people should be available, that sexuality was something that was enhanced by being broadened rather than restricted. And I think those two ideas still have a certain degree of value. I mean, I don't think, ironically, the medical facts do not, as I said before, do not necessarily mean that monogamy is desirable or a solution. Monogamy is only a solution between two people who have not been exposed to HTLV-3, and given that tens and tens and tens of thousands of people have been, unless someone is going to argue that those people should stay celibate for the rest of their lives, one has to find new and inventive ways of having sex that is safe. And that's, I think, the positive side of the gay response, at least sexually, to this epidemic.
My guest is Dennis Altman, and he's the author of the new book, AIDS in the Mind of America. What kind of effect do you think that AIDS is having on the political organizing within the gay movement? Because so much attention is being put on AIDS. Do you think that other important issues are being put on the back burner? Do you think that priorities are being shifted?
Well, obviously priorities are shifting. What else could one do? I mean, in a sense, people have no choice. I think that AIDS has ironically probably made the gay movement much more respectable. That is, the realities of dealing with AIDS have meant that governments at all levels, even including the White House, have had to talk to people in the gay movement, often reluctantly and often secretly. But that's going on. There are increasing numbers of people who hold political positions as openly gay appointments. You have more and more task forces, you know, at state and local levels dealing with AIDS, on which people from the gay community sit because public health officials realize that they have to talk with these people. In fact, one of the great problems, clearly, is when you deal with other people affected by AIDS, most particularly with intravenous drug users, you don't have any sort of communal organizations from which you can get representatives. So in that sense, I suppose in some, you know, rather perverse, macabre way, AIDS has strengthened the gay movement. I don't think, on the whole, the gay movement is dealing with it particularly well. I mean, I don't think that there has been sufficient response at a political level. There's been an amazing response at a sort of local volunteer level looking after people who are sick. And some of the volunteer organizations are doing extraordinary work. But the gay political groups who are needed desperately to lobby and push governments into responding more appropriately and into preventing the major discrimination that some people want to use AIDS as a reason for, those groups are not really growing in the way they ought to be.
What kind of lobbying or organizing would you like to see groups outside of the gay community doing? It's easy for people to say, well, I'm not gay, it's a gay disease, it doesn't really affect me, and a lot of people have been saying that. But what kind of organizing would you like to see other groups doing in the health and political areas?
I find it extraordinary. Well, see, I find two things extraordinary. I mean, one is that when people are dying, the group to which they can be assigned membership is more important than the fact that people are dying. And that clearly is the response of a lot of people. Nobody seems to be saying thousands and thousands of people, men, women, and children, have died. They're saying over and over again, lots of gay men are dying, it's not my issue. The second thing is this constant reiteration that this is a gay disease, a gay issue. Nobody is saying we have here a health crisis. One of the basic reasons for having governments at all is to protect human beings, to protect life, to look after people's health. We don't, for example, when we talk about making money available to do research into heart disease, go around saying, oh, well, lots of type A businessmen get heart disease because they work themselves too hard. It's their fault. And besides, they've got lots of money, so, you know, they can pay for it. Nobody says that. We don't even say it about people dying from lung cancer, although the link with cigarette smoking is extremely well established. When it comes to AIDS, immediately we say it. The connection in the public mind between homosexuality and AIDS is so great that it literally leads people not to see what is happening. And the bottom line is that people are dying, and they are dying unpleasant and painful and degrading deaths, and they are dying those deaths at a young age. In fact, children, babies are being born with AIDS who will die, you know, in early infancy, and that is not being seen. And so when you say what can other groups do, it's not what can other groups do, I think that's the issue. It's what can human beings do to try to prevent deaths of other human beings. And in a humane society, that should be the bottom line. It doesn't matter who the other human beings are. Now, unfortunately, that has not been the response in this country. And I think very clearly the major responsibility lies with President Reagan. He is the one person who has the ability to make Americans understand this. And his silence on AIDS compared to his willingness to, say, go on television and cry because one child needed a liver transplant, or to constantly invoke the fetuses who die in abortions, his unwillingness to deal with the fact that fellow Americans are dying is, I think, one of the very major reasons why the response in this country has been so limited and basically, I think, so inhumane and so lacking in compassion.
As you, I think, pointed out before, people who lose their jobs or get sick when they don't have a job probably don't have health insurance mm-hmm. either, because health insurance in this country is usually tied to a benefit of a full-time paid position. So if you're freelance, you don't have health insurance either. Do you think that AIDS calls into question the whole method of health insurance in this country?
It's very interesting you ask that, because as an Australian, which I guess people could tell from the accent, I'm not American. The thing that I found most staggering when I first started looking at AIDS and, you know, had to start asking questions about how the health system worked were the real extraordinary limitations to health coverage in this country. The United States is really unique among Western democratic nations in not having universal national health insurance. Everywhere else, it is taken for granted that somehow, using some system or another, everybody in a country should be guaranteed at least minimum health care. What has happened with AIDS has, I think, underlined something that's already an enormous problem. And it's not, this is not a gay issue, it's not even an AIDS-specific issue. The reality is that this country looks after its sick who are not wealthy worse than anywhere else in the world. Now, I find that the resistance, even from AIDS organizations, if you raise this, is enormous, that somehow people have got into their heads the idea, well, that's okay, that's how it is. But in fact, it needn't be like this. And the very nature of AIDS, the fact that it hits people who are young, that it often leads to people being sick for long periods and unable to work, that very many people get AIDS-related complex, ARC, which is not classified by Social Security as a disease, you know, that automatically gets them on welfare. You get large numbers of people, you know, who are totally stranded, who have lost their jobs, have lost their health coverage, don't qualify for welfare, have been rejected by their family, have been turned out by their allegedly Christian churches, who literally would die on the streets if it weren't for the struggling AIDS organizations trying to look after them. And as I say, that is a blind spot. People do not see that. The newspapers don't talk about that. That's not sexy. Sexy is Rock Hudson dying or bathhouses. But the reality is that in terms of human suffering, it's at the level of the health and welfare services that AIDS, that most could be done. Because even before a cure, even before a vaccine, we can at least make sure that people who are sick are properly cared for.
I really think most Americans aren't psychologically equipped to face an epidemic that A, is fatal, and B, kills young people. Because even something like cancer, which everybody's afraid of, for the most part, people who are older get it. And, I mean, I think a lot of people know someone who was young and had cancer and maybe died or maybe survived it. But the majority of the people seem to be older. So there's there isn't that tragedy of somebody getting struck down in the prime of their life. I'm not trying to make light of cancer in any way. But I think we're totally psychologically unequipped to see people in their 20s and 30s and teens dying of an uncurable disease, as AIDS is right now, uncurable.
I think that's absolutely true. And if you talk to people who work in hospitals, they will tell you this, that nothing in their training has equipped them to deal with this. I don't think, in all fairness, that this is just an American reaction. I think it's true for almost everybody under a certain age in the Western world. Probably the only people, you know, who really can deal with this are people old enough to have lived through the great flu epidemic of 1919.
Which killed a lot of people in Philadelphia.
Yes, and killed a lot of people in their 20s and 30s. But since then, except for war, which of course has killed very many people, we're not used to the idea of an epidemic disease with which medicine can't cope. I mean, I suppose the last one was polio, but polio didn't really seem to kill as many people. One didn't have the sense, I think, even at the height of polio, that it was a threat to human lives in quite the way this is. Which again, is, you know, as you don't want to minimize cancer, I certainly don't want to minimize polio.
You've lived for the past 5 years or so, partly in Australia and partly in America. So you've been seeing, and you've also alternated in America between the West Coast and the East Coast. So you've seen different state governments and federal governments trying to cope with the AIDS epidemic. And I'm sure you've been following the international press as well. Would you offer any country or state as a model of how to do it right? And what do you think the responsibility of the state should be?
I think that Let's restrict ourselves for the moment, anyway, to the United States, because the particular nature of the American system, and in particular the failure to have a national health system that works. Within the United States, I think very clearly San Francisco, which is both a city and a county, is a model for everywhere else. There is nowhere else that has come close to San Francisco. And the San Francisco model is actually a very simple one. The city of San Francisco, from the mayor on down, has made it clear that the resources of the city will be mobilized to try to do everything that can be done to look after people with AIDS and to spread as much information and preventive information as is possible. Now, the way they do it is essentially by working in conjunction with community-based groups, so that in San Francisco, the AIDS Foundation and the Shanty Program, which does most of the counseling and home support, are very heavily subsidised and supported by the city. This is a model that has actually been adopted to some extent in Australia, where we have the great fortune of having a federal minister for health who actually cares that people are dying. Now, unfortunately, at a federal level in this country, the administration has totally refused to accept that sort of responsibility. The federal government has been concerned with funding research, which has been done largely through pressure from Congress against a reluctant administration, but not with providing overall services. And then it becomes this sort of awful patchwork of city and county and state governments. A few states, particularly California and New York, have made monies available in substantial amounts. But I think it's important to get clear what we can expect governments to do. I mean, everyone agrees we can expect governments to underwrite research, and you can argue how much, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that's universally accepted now. The second question is, what can governments and what should governments do to look after the people who are sick? And here there's clearly a great discrepancy, and Reaganomics and the Graham-Rudman budget cuts are going to have an enormous effect, but not just, of course, on people with AIDS, on anyone who's sick and does not have adequate coverage, which increasingly, with a long-lasting disease, means the entire population. Thirdly, there's the question of what can and should governments do in terms of prevention education. Now, the administration has been very reluctant to get into this. It's been, again, a patchwork of some cities and some state governments. And, again, California is, I suppose, the model for the rest of the country. At the moment, the Centers for Disease Control are making some monies available with lots of strings attached. And it's very unclear whether that's going to allow for adequate informational programs to get out. I think the reality is that if we look at it, the nature of American government, which is extremely localized, federalized, broken up, has meant that outside a couple of places, and San Francisco really is, I think, clearly the model, the response has not been adequate. And it's not been adequate to meet both the caseload and to deal with the enormous need to dispel public concerns, to deal with the often unreasoned and irrational hysteria. And I suppose most importantly, to get out the information we were talking about earlier that will help people make sensible decisions that might cut down the transmission of this disease.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was Dennis Altman, author of the new book, AIDS in the Mind of America, published by Doubleday. This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, and this is the second half of our two-day special series on AIDS. Today we're looking at the political, social, and legal impact of the epidemic. Misinformation and irrational fears have not only tapped into homophobia and raised civil liberties questions, but they have scared some people out of donating or receiving blood from the Red Cross. AIDS can be transmitted through the blood, and in the past, there were cases where people got AIDS through blood transfusions, but the Red Cross says this is no longer a problem. Last April, a test was put into effect that detects the presence of antibodies to the HTLV-3 virus, the virus that causes AIDS. Anyone who has AIDS or who has been directly exposed to the virus tests positive. All donated blood is now screened for the virus. If the blood tests positive, it's discarded and never enters the blood supply. Fresh Air's Amy Sallet spoke with Kathleen Denton, the Director of Communications for the Southeastern Pennsylvania Chapter of the Red Cross. They talked about the state of Philadelphia's blood supply.
How does the Red Cross assure that the blood supply does not contain the AIDS virus?
We actually have quite a number of steps, and the first one is the volunteer blood donor. And I stress that it's a volunteer, a person who has no reason to give blood except for altruistic good reasons to help someone. We don't pay blood donors. One of the major things is that we have asked the donors to be very truthful, and if they are a member of the high-risk groups for AIDS, we ask them to defer themselves from the donor base. And we've actually had quite a great cooperation from this very first step. Last year, we instituted the first test for the antibody for AIDS called the HTLV-3 test. And now, since actually April 1st of 1985, every unit of blood that we collect is tested for this antibody. And of course, if the test is positive, the blood is destroyed.
How accurate is the test? Have you been able to find yet that maybe some of this blood that is not testing positive is still transmitting the AIDS virus?
So far, so good. We feel that the test is actually super sensitive. We are probably finding more positives than our true positives. And, of course, we'd much rather err on that side of things. Right now, however, there are only about 0.02% of all of the blood donors that we see who are testing positive for this test. And to bring that down in terms, we collect about 30,000 pints of blood a month. And of this, maybe 60 are testing positive. After that test is performed, then we take it to another level, a much more a test called the Western blot, which is able to be much more specific. And of that, we're maybe getting 12 positives out of 30,000 donors.
There are other blood banks that pay people to donate blood. They're not connected with the Red Cross. And we could imagine that maybe many people who do use drugs or possibly prostitutes or maybe even people with AIDS might be giving blood to these blood banks in order to get some money. Now, what's the relationship of these blood banks to the Red Cross and the overall blood supply that's going to the hospitals? And do you know if these blood banks are testing their blood?
We really have, with the American Red Cross, no connection with these commercial blood banks. Most of the blood that they collect is actually used for the plasma, and that's spun down into specific products, not the variety that you would see normally in a hospital or used for transfusion. One thing I can say, in the Penn Jersey region, all of the blood that's used in hospitals come from volunteer blood donors. And I think that's really important, because the commercial blood, no matter how well it's tested, still is recognized to have a much higher content of hepatitis and other kinds of diseases like this that can be transmitted.
AIDS first began to come into the consciousness of people here in the United States, I think, around 1981. And the test for the HTLV-3 virus was developed in April of 1985. Now, what went on in the Philadelphia area or the southeastern Pennsylvania area? Were there cases of people getting AIDS from transfusions?
I believe at this point, from all of the years back, as well as right now, there was one confirmed case. I might say that in our area, we make 800,000 products per year, blood products. And so that is a, I guess you could say, a very small percentage of people who did contract that disease.
Is there any chance of getting AIDS when you're giving blood?
Very good question. And I'd like to say absolutely not. You cannot get AIDS by giving blood. And the reasons for this are fairly simple. We have our registered nurses who are taking the blood from the donor's arm and using a sterile needle, which is used one time and then discarded. And everything that comes in contact with that donor is sterile, very clean, and actually is pitched right after the donation. And there's no possibility of shared needles or contamination of blood.
Since you've been asking certain groups of people not to give blood, and since some of the blood, a small percentage, but some of the blood is not usable, has the blood supply dropped off dramatically in the last 4 years?
We really can't say that it's dropped off dramatically. There have been dips. We traditionally know that we're going to have trouble collecting blood in the summer, hot summer days when people are on vacations and the workforce is not as heavy. We also know that we're going to have problems right after the Christmas season and through February. What's happened is that this has been increased. The problem of fear, the walking fearful, who are afraid that they might be able to get AIDS by giving blood, have pulled back. We don't really feel that these people were in the donor base to begin with. Our regular donors are still giving. What we find is that we need more of the first-time donors. And with all of the efforts that we're making to get donors, we should have more. And I think that's where we've run into the problem.
If someone gives blood and you test it and you find that it does test positive for the HTLV-3 virus, do you tell them?
What we do is confirm the test in our own labs. So we do it once, and if it is positive, we do it again. And if it's positive, we send it off to a laboratory in Illinois. And basically, they do the Western blot test. And as I said, that's much more specific. If that's positive, indeed, we do inform the donor, and they receive a personal letter from our director.
What if they don't want to know?
If a person would not wish to know, basically, they shouldn't give blood, because we owe it to our donor population to inform them on any irregularity in their blood. And this is known before a person gives us permission to collect their blood.
Is information that someone's blood is tested positive, is that protected in any way from other people finding this out?
It's highly confidential. As a matter of fact, we only use coded numbers when it comes to this test, as well as the other tests that we have, which is for syphilis and hepatitis and, of course, the ABO or H type. But with the HTLV-3 test, we use a code, and it is strictly confidential, and people, even in our laboratories, cannot track a name with the code. There's about one or two people in the laboratory who have access to this information.
Have any groups, such as insurance companies or maybe the federal government, come to the Red Cross to ask for the names of people who tested positive?
To date, the only group that has requested and receives this information is the Department of Army. When we go to military bases, we inform donors in advance that if they test positive for HTLV-3, that it is an Army regulation that the commanding officer and the medical person under the commanding officer, I should say, would receive this information, and we must turn it over to them.
And on the military bases, is that just the people who choose to donate blood, or do they all have to be tested?
When it comes to the blood mobiles, it's only the people who choose to give blood.
Would it be possible for the government to, at some point, let's say that the government decides that they really want to quarantine these people and they came to the Red Cross and demanded the names of people who tested positive, what would the Red Cross do?
We would probably consult with our lawyers. I do know that confidentiality is definitely one of the most important things that we hold very highly, and we regard the privacy of the donor as to be sacred. The only time that we have ever released or done things that perhaps we wouldn't normally do is under court order. And I would think that in a situation like that, we would have very firm legal advice.
That was Kathleen Denton, Director of Communications for the Southeastern Pennsylvania Chapter of the Red Cross. She spoke with Fresh Air's Amy Salad. The test that screens for the presence of the AIDS virus is not 100% accurate. There is a very small chance of getting a negative reading when you actually are infected with the virus, and there is an even greater chance of testing positive when there is no AIDS virus present. Yesterday, a new, more accurate test was approved. Though the test has become an invaluable tool for screening the blood supply, it has also brought about an array of other possible applications, some of which many legal experts say violate civil liberties. We'll talk to one of those experts in a few minutes. These are some of the more controversial uses of the test. The U.S. military is now screening all recruits and active duty personnel and discharging or reassigning those who test positive. Some insurance companies are now testing people who apply for health and life insurance policies. Proposals have been made to test employees and job applicants at hospitals and restaurants, and it has even been suggested that the government should quarantine everyone who tests positive. It's important to remember that the current test only confirms your exposure to the virus that causes AIDS. If you test positive, it doesn't mean you have AIDS. It means your blood has been directly exposed to the virus and you've built up antibodies to it. The National Centers for Disease Control estimate that if you test positive, you have a 5 to 20% chance of actually getting AIDS. If you test positive, you may or may not be a carrier of AIDS. There's presently no way of determining that for sure. Here in Pennsylvania, a group of state representatives has recently proposed legislation that would require all people applying for a marriage license to be tested for the HTLV-3 virus. Fresh Air's associate producer Amy Sallet spoke with one of the bill's sponsors, Representative Russell Letterman, a Democrat from District 17. They spoke about House Bill 2032.
You have proposed some legislation about AIDS. Could you explain what it says, please?
Well, all it says is that you must take a test prior to marriage for AIDS.
And if one of the couple does test positive for the AIDS virus, what would happen?
They would not be allowed to be married.
And why do you feel that legislation like that is appropriate? What would it accomplish?
Well, the only thing I'm trying to do is to make sure we don't have children born with AIDS.
Have many of your constituents come to you with fears about AIDS, and what kinds of things have they been saying?
I was listening to a news broadcast where the American Medical Association has considered asking the states to do something in this form. And I believe in what the program was talking about and definitely think that something should be done. In the older days when we used to require blood tests for people getting married to make sure they didn't have any kind of venereal diseases, I don't see anything wrong with it, and I definitely think we're in a crisis, and we should try to stop it in every way that we can. So it doesn't. I don't see any reason why we should allow it to go on and people get married that have AIDS, and then have children, and more people come up with AIDS.
Have many people in your district come to you with fears about AIDS and asked you to do something?
Well, we've got fears of it because we live in a major university. And we have people from all around, you know, coming into our area, and there are cases of AIDS at the university. And everybody is concerned, no matter where you go, they're concerned.
Do you think that legislation is a way to deal with AIDS?
No, not entirely, but I do think this is one of the appropriate places for it.
Is there other legislation that you would like to see in effect other than just this screening for a marriage license?
Well, not at the present time. I'm even aware that there's a negative and a positive look at AIDS to whether or not people, even if they test positive, does not guarantee that they're going to spread it. And I'm well aware of all that. But the thing is that I see no reason for two people that test out to have AIDS, or even if one of them do, why they should get married and take the chance that would be transferred to a young child. We have enough to take care of in this country as far as free service to people and the amount of people that the working man is keeping today on welfare without having other people added to the rolls unnecessarily.
What do you mean? Who would be added to the welfare rolls?
Evidently, you know, most people, if they come up with AIDS, they would expect some kind of extra treatment and special treatment paid for by the government. You know, right now they're all out hollering that we're not doing enough. The federal government's not doing enough and putting more money toward the fight of AIDS.
Uh-huh. And do you agree with that or disagree with that?
Well, you know, I'm sure the government didn't give these people AIDS.
So what does that
mean?
But
I do think it is a crisis. I do think it is something that government should be taking a very serious look at and dealing with today.
What do you think the government should be doing about AIDS?
Well, I think possibly they should be testing and trying to deal with finding a cure. They should be putting more money toward finding a cure. But as far as individual hospitalization payments and treatments and everything like that, I don't see how any one government could afford to pay for all the people who's come down with it.
At this point, the test, the HTLV-3 test, that tests to see if you have an antibody against the AIDS virus in your system, many of the researchers, it is a fairly new test. And as you actually mentioned earlier, people really don't know what it means. It's possible that over 90% of the people who test positive actually will never come down with AIDS or transmit it. It's somewhat unknown. So if people did go to get a marriage license and they tested positive, what do you think about the civil liberties of those people, that they wouldn't be able to get married when possibly most of them, a very large percentage of them, actually do not have AIDS?
But you just said the magic word. You said during research they cannot say, right?
Yes, I did say that.
That's all I'm worried about, what they can't say. Yeah, these researchers will not say that people will not transmit AIDS to somebody else when they test positive. They will not say that they can't give it to other people. They just say maybe to one they can't, but to another person they can.
Mm-hmm. But that works both ways. Since it is uncertain that they actually are a transmitter of AIDS, can we legally keep them from getting married?
Let me put it to you as direct as I can put it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Say you and I were going to get married, and we both were tested for AIDS. I tested positive and you tested negative. Would you still want to marry me?
I don't know. I would have to think about it.
You know you wouldn't want to marry me, dear. You know very well you wouldn't want to marry me. You don't want to have to think about that for 2 minutes. What I'm saying. A lot of people would be getting married that don't even know that someone else had AIDS. And that's the point.
Now, people who are really concerned about this can demand that their partner get a test on their own. Why do you feel this should be legislated instead of just left to each individual choice to decide whether they want to be tested or not?
Well, I just feel that they're not going to do it. And I think that most people should be protected when something like this is going on.
And that it's the role of the government to protect them instead of they protecting themselves.
If that's what has to be done. And I feel at this time that it is one of the things that we should require for marriage, yes.
Since at this point, almost 90% of all AIDS cases in this country are among gay men and intravenous drug users, particularly gay men do not tend to get married, and probably a large percentage of IV drug users don't get married either. Why did you choose the institution of marriage as a way to approach the AIDS crisis?
I just explained it to you, I think, very well. When I ask you, if you and I were to be married and I tested positive and you tested negative, would you want to marry me? And I think that's a very good explanation of why I'm doing this, is so both people going into a marriage understand exactly what they're getting into. There's many cases that are turning up throughout this country. You know, it doesn't mean just because you're gay that you have AIDS. It can be contacted through people giving blood or getting blood or doing anything. And I don't think a lot of people would care to get married if they knew one of their partners had AIDS.
You just said that AIDS, you can get AIDS by giving blood. Could you explain how that happens?
By getting blood.
You can't get it by giving blood, though, right?
Well, I don't know if you could or not. If you weren't tested properly and someone messed up and you took blood from a person with AIDS, I guess you would get it.
In the legislation you're proposing, is there any mention of confidentiality as to who tests positive and who doesn't?
No.
Are you concerned about that?
Well, it's something to think about, something that I can consider in this legislation.
But it is not written in there now?
No.
Okay, thank you very much for talking with us. Yeah, goodbye.
Bye.
That was State Representative Russell Letterman, a co-sponsor of proposed Pennsylvania state legislation that would require all marriage license applicants to be tested for the AIDS virus. Those who test positive would be denied a marriage license. This is Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, and this is the second half of our two-day series on AIDS. Just to set the record straight on a couple of Representative Letterman's points, you cannot get AIDS by donating blood. As Kathleen Denton stated earlier, the Red Cross uses disposable needles that are used once and are then thrown away. Also, Representative Letterman stated that the American Medical Association recommends the type of legislation he is proposing. But according to William Small, Director of Information Services for the AMA, the AMA voted to oppose such a mandatory blood test at a meeting last December. According to Small, the doctors oppose a legislative approach to containing AIDS. They recommend that we channel our efforts into education about how the disease is spread. Many civil liberties experts agree. They're concerned about the use of the HTLV-3 blood test to screen out insurance applicants, job applicants, workers, and military personnel. They've been monitoring the many AIDS-related bills that have been proposed around the country and are weighing how to balance the rights of people with AIDS with the rights of people who hope to protect themselves from the disease. With me to discuss the legal and civil liberties questions raised by the AIDS epidemic is Philadelphia-based lawyer David Weber. Weber is the legal director for the Advocacy Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force, and he's the legal counsel for the Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force. Last year, he represented a person with AIDS who was fired from his job. He also consulted on a case against the U.S. military for discharging Navy recruits who tested positive for the AIDS virus. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
Do you see civil liberties issues coming in conflict now with health concerns during this AIDS epidemic?
Well, I see them coming in conflict where the health concerns are not very well based on what we really know about this illness or how it is transmitted. So where someone's taking a public health policy position, which is poorly informed, then there's usually a conflict with civil liberties. But I think the conflict overall between the civil liberties or civil rights and the public health issues, sort of this notion that there's a conflict between the society's interest in overall public health and the individual's interest in exercising their right to do whatever it may be, that to some extent is really a kind of a false way to state this problem or to describe the situation. That if you look first at the public health issues and develop a very sound public health approach, you'll find in virtually every case that it's going to be consistent with the generally recognized civil liberties tradition in the United States, and that you're not going to be violating people's rights. In fact, you want to do just the opposite. You want to protect people's rights, assure them of, say, confidentiality in the use of test results.
One of the big issues for a lot of people, I think, is how to balance the civil liberties of the person who's sick and is contagious under certain circumstances with the person who is well but is very worried that they're going to contact the disease. So how do you take that balance into consideration, and how do the specific characteristics of the AIDS virus enter into that?
Well, that's a concern that always comes up, and it actually, when you start to look at the specific situations, and look at why people are concerned, or should they be concerned, about their health, say, whether they're going to get this illness from somebody else, and that somebody else ought to be restrained in some way so they can't spread it through the disease through the population generally. Well, look at the what we know about the transmission of AIDS, and it's clear that it is very difficult to transmit through any casual contact, if not just plain impossible to transmit. So you're asking, in a way, a kind of question about quarantine, for example, one way to describe it. So if you look at what would be an appropriate quarantine approach that sort of meets the needs of the communicability of this illness, quarantine, in a way, just doesn't make sense. There's no reason to restrain someone from having contact with people in public or in the workplace, for example, if they're not going to be able to communicate the virus in those settings. And there's no evidence that they do communicate them, even in those settings, even in healthcare facilities. The cases of people caring for people with AIDS, where the healthcare personnel come down with develop the virus or even develop AIDS at some point, those cases are so rare to suggest that even there, where the healthcare personnel have exposure or contact with body fluids, which is one way the virus could be transmitted. Even there, in virtually every case, and there are thousands of AIDS patients, healthcare professionals, nurses, doctors, and even dentists, they're not developing problems with AIDS.
So you think the whole question of quarantine is really totally pointless and useless for this particular epidemic. But have people been bringing it up seriously?
It's always a question which is raised, but there's just no there's no basis for looking at it that way. If this were a disease where you had an airborne microbe or something like that, where you could go to a theater and someone with AIDS could breathe on you and cause you to develop the virus, that might be a different situation, but that's not what's going on here, and we know that's not what's happening.
If you have a contagious disease like AIDS, do you have a legal right to tell people who, I mean, a legal obligation to tell people who are close to you, especially your lovers,
Is it a legal or a moral responsibility to tell them?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. It cuts both ways. First of all, it seems very clear to me that one would have a moral responsibility to inform someone of your health situation so that they can decide for themselves what kind of involvement they would want to have with you. But the problem which might come up is in a situation where someone might not be totally clear about their own health or whether they could even communicate the virus or whether they have it. And by identifying themselves as, say, being part of a high-risk group, they may expose themselves to very significant discrimination. So it would be a very difficult, in some settings, some situations, very difficult for an individual to make that judgment. But basically, they could be, say, liable later on if they did not disclose the information, and a former lover or lover then later could have proved that they had been exposed to the virus. That may be something very difficult to prove and something no one would want to even try to go through proving. But if they could try to do that, legally they would have a claim. They could bring a lawsuit and sue a former lover for damages, I suppose, although those cases are very rare.
So currently there's no legal sanctions for not practicing safe sex if you have AIDS?
No. The only thing where there might be an issue is something we may even get into later is whether or not there might be some criminal liability in knowingly transmitting the AIDS virus. But again, that's very rare where those situations arise.
There are many questions raised by the current blood test that we have now. And again, the blood test tests for antibodies to the HTLV-3 virus. It doesn't mean you have AIDS. It doesn't even mean you're going to get AIDS. It means there's a 5 to 19% chance or 20% chance, according to the CDC, that you're going to eventually get AIDS. Now, if you test positive, do you think that those results should be reported to anyone, such as the city and state health authorities? Colorado just instituted a law where if you test positive, the results have to go to the city and state health authorities.
Now, I don't like that idea at all. I'll tell you, with Colorado, what will happen, I think, is Coloradans will go outside the state to have blood tests done if they want to have the test done. I generally don't recommend that people go have the test done. It's not of any medical value. Doctors generally don't recommend it if they know anything about the illness or about what use can be made of the test results. So it's a peculiar test in that way. It gives you certain information which may be significant. As you said, it may be significant for figures I've heard are 5 to 10% or maybe as high as 20% of the people, but very little predictive value. You don't know that you're going to develop AIDS. And even if you're in that, let's assume it's 20% that of individuals who might develop AIDS, you don't know when that might happen. What I think is a much sounder approach is to encourage and let people know that if they're in a high-risk group, gay men or intravenous drug users, those individuals ought to practice safe sex and avoid exposing other people unnecessarily or unknowingly to the risk of the transmission of the virus.
So you're opposed to, well, you don't recommend somebody voluntarily taking on the test because you don't think it's going to be of any help to them. They should be practicing safe sex anyways. And it's going to add all these questions for which there are no answers.
That's right. We don't know what's going to be made, what sort of use will be made of that data. And in this society, is, you know, whenever someone develops a test, even though the test results, the information which is derived from the test, may not be very relevant for anything. The test is always given just because the technology seems to be available. People think, well, let's test everyone, let's screen people for this antibody, even though the information isn't of much use at all in a public health sense. It's useful only to people maybe who want to treat those individuals unfairly. And that's the risk, that we don't know in the future what will happen to that data once it might be compiled, held by some agency. And I shudder to think that some state or city bureaucrat will have this information about so many individuals where there may not be controls about where that information goes and what purposes it's used for, when that information can mean the loss of a job or other very basic rights that you might hold in society.
There are several proposals out now for mandatory blood tests in some instances, it's already being used. Are you ever in favor of a mandatory blood test to test for the AIDS virus?
Well, I can't think of any circumstance where it, given this the particular nature of this test, it's going to be very useful. And when you look at this problem overall, you have to realize if you're assessing the government's approach, if it's the government that's going to impose this test, it's a very intrusive test. It stigmatizes the individual. It may deprive the individual of important rights. As I said, they may lose their job. Who knows what down the road might happen. So if the government's going to impose that kind of intrusion and testing on individuals, they've got to be able to justify it very strongly, a compelling interest in doing that. And given what little the test tells you medically or in the public health context, since the information is not very useful, it would be difficult to legally see that kind of testing upheld. So I can't see any situation where it is either correct as a public health approach purely, or where it would be consistent with civil liberties concerns.
What about the issue of the military? The military now has a mandatory blood test for recruits and for people who are already in the military. And if you test positive for that, you're either discharged or you can also be put into a different position, which where the risk wouldn't be that significant. Is this a legitimate instance, since in the military, if you're in combat, you're apt to be wounded and bleed and might bleed? If you had the virus, you might be bleeding onto someone else who had an open wound, thereby transmitting the disease. Is this a legitimate use of the test?
I don't think so, though. It's unlikely that the testing in the military would be successfully challenged, given the fact that once you join the military, you lose a lot of your basic rights. The basic right to privacy doesn't exist in the military the way it does in the civilian society. So from a technical legal point of view, challenges to the military policy may not be very successful, depending on the setting. But what, just the same, the military policy doesn't make very much sense. And I'd not heard really the argument that people might bleed on each other, but the way I've heard the military people articulate that is that they need to have individuals in combat settings available to provide blood for transfusion purposes. Now, I believe the military takes a completely different approach to other communicable diseases. And what they do is they identify the individual who either has the disease or the virus. They tell that individual, they could identify them on their dog tags or wherever, that or have the individual inform people under those circumstances that they are not to be used for the transfusion. And of course, in a life and death situation, one could imagine you get down to the last guy in the unit and he's the one who has whatever the virus is, and the choice is, what, do you want to use his blood for the transfusion and keep someone alive, or let the person possibly die not having the availability of the transfusion? Of course, the whole concept of the combat situation where transfusions are necessary, can be dealt with, as the military is dealing with it, by not discharging people but transferring them from where they think the war is supposed to happen to some stateside assignment. And there they're not supposed to be put in that awful situation of having to provide the blood for the transfusion.
So you can't think of any circumstance in which you think a mandatory government legislated blood test would be appropriate. Now, there are private companies who are trying to do blood tests, and I'm thinking here, for instance, of insurance companies who would rather not pay the expenses if somebody gets AIDS. And the CDC estimates that the average person with AIDS has about a $147,000 bill
I think some of those figures are really exaggerated, but that's debated in medical circles what the expenses really involved.
So some insurance companies have proposed blood tests so that they could see if their insuree has been exposed to the AIDS virus or not.
Yeah, that is very unfair. What end up doing is discouraging people from even applying to obtain insurance benefits. And if an individual tests positive on that antibody test, as we've been discussing, there's no way to say that they're likely to develop AIDS. So we'd have to assume that at least 80% of those individuals are going to get turned down when they apply for insurance coverage, that they're never going to have the medical problem that the insurance industry is worried about. And, of course, there's the issue also of given that the sort of if that is correct, that 80% figure, that those individuals should be insured, we just don't know who is in the 80% group. There's a question about the fairness then of denying them the coverage and eliminating coverage for individuals who actually might develop AIDS, who otherwise could pay into the system as an insurance subscriber and for years before there are any signs, any symptoms of the illness actually develop. But they may have had the antibody and the virus for years and years before that ever develops.
Is it legal for an insurance company to ask for a blood test, and are there insurance companies already doing that?
Well, this varies state by state. In Wisconsin, there was a statewide law adopted which very severely restricted the insurance company's ability to do that sort of testing. And the insurance industry has a very effective lobby, and they managed to get that provision reversed so that they are able to test. And this varies from state to state. Generally, state laws on insurance bar discrimination, say, on the basis of sex or marital status. So they couldn't discriminate against all single men in metropolitan areas, for example. But they probably can, under current law, give that kind of test. And that's going to be one of the big disputes and issues that undoubtedly will be debated in the legislatures about whether or not insurance companies are allowed to do that kind of testing.
Insurance companies play the odds. They hope they insure you and nothing's going to happen. Are they trying to screen out people who they consider to be high-risk situations? And are there leading questions showing up on forms now designed to screen out the high-risk population people?
Well, there have been some instances I know of on a national basis where the AIDS antibody test has been administered before they would consider insuring an individual. Now, that has come up, and there are complaints about that sort of thing going on. But in general, at this point, they're not changing the application forms, although maybe they're in the works now. It's certainly something they're concerned about, so there aren't really significant changes in insurance companies' approaches. And they've said recently, some of the underwriters, that they're not changing their approach on this. But that may happen. In fact, I advise gay clients of mine, if they're looking at their insurance coverage, they may want to consider applying for insurance now, obtaining coverage before the standards change.